from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Stanford professor and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, says that the Senate impeachment trial will bring with it a new flood of disinformation. In a Washington Post op-ed this week, McFaul talks about how the public and politicians can guard against disinformation tactics perfected by the Kremlin. We'll also get an update on the latest impeachment news ahead of Tuesday, when the Senate trial is set to resume. That's all next on Forum. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A momentous week in Washington. That's far from over with the latest revelations about casualties from the Iran missile attacks. Also yesterday, of course, the third ever impeachment trial in U.S. history began with Chief Justice of the Supreme Court John Roberts administering the oath to U.S. senators to do, quote, impartial justice during the trial. With fresh questions about the conduct of the president and his administration related to Ukraine from both the GAO and documents supplied by businessman Lev Parnas, we'll spend the hour with Stanford professor and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. First, though, Politico's Anita Kumar is with us. Thanks for joining us, Anita Kumar.
Sure.
She's
Thanks.
White House.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you being here. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor. And, of course, I have to begin by asking you about the president's legal team that seems to be expanding. Tell us who is on it and what's behind his choices.
Well, we expected the lead to be from the White House counsel's office, and that is what we saw. But it's these outside attorneys that he announced today that have some people raising their eyebrows a little bit. There are a lot of well-known people. One of them is Ken Starr, who people will remember prosecuted President Clinton he investigated President Clinton when he was impeached. And then Alan Dershowitz was another name, someone who has been defending the president out on television a lot lately, but a lot of people know him recently from being the attorney or being one of the attorneys for Jeffrey Epstein, who people will remember was accused of sexual assault. So there are a couple names there. He also has the Florida Attorney General, or the former Florida Attorney General, Pam Bondi, who's been working temporarily at the White House for a few months. And there'll be a few other people. But, people sort of were surprised, I think, at some of the names. Some of them are controversial names. And I think one of the reasons that he liked some of these people that I'm understanding is that they are well known. They've been in this situation before, for Ken Starr. Obviously, he was with, working on that Bill Clinton case. And he likes people that are famous and out there on TV and that are recognizable.
Do you think it also reveals where he feels most vulnerable in terms of his arguments?
Well, I do think that the main attorneys will be two that are that have been with him for a while. One is the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and one is his personal attorney, Jay Sekulow. So I do think those two will be taking the lead. But what we might see is those other attorneys taking particular pieces of the case that they might have more insight into or more knowledge about, experience in. And I think that's how it's going to work. But he was clear to say that the two attorneys that we expected would take the lead.
So the Senate trial is set to resume on Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Just remind us what will happen that day.
Well, what we already saw was the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who's come over from the Supreme Court and swear all the senators in, who will be serving as jurors. What we're expecting now is before even Tuesday, for the White House or rather the president's legal team to respond to these accusations against him. So that's like a formal process that has already happened, has already been sent over to the White House, to the president. And now we're waiting for response. That response is due by Saturday evening, Eastern time. So we'll get a sense of what they're saying there. Of course, we have kind of seen what they're saying. The president and his team have been out there saying they don't feel that he's done anything wrong. So what we're going to see is the House saying what they feel that the president did wrong, what these articles are about, and we'll also see the president's team saying how they didn't feel they did anything wrong and how they're defending him. Then will be the really big part of the trial, I think, that a lot of people in Washington are waiting for. Will the Senate allow witnesses to testify or not? That's been back and forth for months now.
Yes.
And we still don't know the answer to that.
Though we are seeing, I mean, we saw Senator Susan Collins of Maine suggesting that she would likely support bringing witnesses in, though she wouldn't say which witnesses she would like to hear from.
Right. Senator Collins also said she's been meeting with a small group of senators, we don't know who, that do want witnesses. We know that Senator Mitt Romney has also said he would be interested in witnesses. He specifically mentioned John Bolton, the former national security advisor. And we know that, you know, maybe one or two more are sort of talking about it, but they haven't really commit for sure. What they're saying now is that they want to go ahead and hear what there is to hear from the House and from the president's team, and then they'll make a decision. It does sound like there could be four Republicans, and that's what's needed, Republicans to side with Democrats and say they do want witnesses. It's just very touch and go right now. It's very unclear, and I don't think we're going to know the answer until these two parts are over, until we get to that point in the trial.
How do you think the revelations, the recent documents from businessman Lev Parnas affected or is affecting the calculation for the Senate Republicans in terms of calling witnesses?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Senate Republicans are telling my colleagues on Capitol Hill, it really hasn't made much of a difference. I think, though, that, it has been very revealing. There have been a lot of people talking about it and saying, you know, that he, Parnas's, you know, both his comments and also these documents sort of back up the things that House Democrats had thought. They're filling in some gaps. And it's also revealing what the president, if what he's saying is true, that's revealing sort of the president's role. And that was one of the big things we didn't really know, because so many of the president's top aides, including his chief of staff and National Security Advisor and others, wouldn't come forward and testify. So we didn't really know what his role was. So I do think that is going to be key. If the Senate Republicans and Senate Democrats even want to know more about the president's role and believe Lev Parnas and want him to come forward, I think that could provide them some information. But I will be quick to tell you that the White House and the president's team have pushed back and said that what Lev Parnas is saying is not the truth. It's not truthful. He has a court case against him. He has been indicted on an unrelated charge, campaign finance charge, and that he's just trying to, testify or, you know, volunteer this information to get a break on that case.
Have they been specifically saying that Parnas is lying or that he's a proven liar? Because those two things are different.
Yes, you're right. They do say he's a proven liar. And they kind of just brush off the other specific allegations. I think it depends on who you talk to, really. But you've heard what the president himself has said, which he said over and over, well, I don't even know who this guy is. You know, I have taken a picture with him. Clearly, it's out there, at least more than one. But I take pictures with lots of people. That doesn't mean that I really know him. And that doesn't mean I worked with him. It really just depends. What there are people like Rudy Giuliani, the president's other attorney, who is not going to be a part of the legal team, his personal attorney, who could shed light on that. But we haven't really heard from him on these details.
There are a lot of questions about how long this impeachment trial in the Senate could last. Of course, if witnesses are called, it would last quite a while, potentially. Where do you put the likelihood that this trial will spill over, say, into the State of the Union address scheduled for February 4th?
The White House actually had a briefing for White House reporters the other day and told us they absolutely expected to be very short, but they are also counting on no witnesses. So when someone asked, how will the president give the State of the Union address, which is scheduled for February 4th, when this is going on, the administration official said, well, we don't expect it to be going on then. I mean, that's pretty quick if that's what they're saying. Over on Capitol Hill, they're talking about 3 to 5 weeks. So that would definitely put us past February 4th. And remember, they're going to meet 6 times a week. So they'll meet Monday through Saturday, generally, obviously not next week because Monday's Martin Luther King Day and they're off. So starting Tuesday, they'll meet Tuesday through Saturday.
And of course, a 2/3 vote is required to remove the president. And Democrats would basically need some 20 Republican senators to break ranks at this point, which is, of course, extremely unlikely, Anita Kumar. But even though people have called the outcome of the Senate trial pretty much a foregone conclusion, all of these latest developments, even just this past week alone, suggest to me, and I'm curious what they suggest to you in terms of whether there might be quite a few surprises during this trial or unexpected twists and turns.
I totally agree. When you talk to people that are close to the president and Republicans, you know, watching this and close to his reelection campaign, they are now realizing what's happened over these last few weeks. It's not just Parnas, it's other documents, it's other things that have come out over, you know, maybe the last 3 or 4 weeks. And they expect that to continue. A couple people have called it sort of the Brett Kavanaugh, equating it to the Brett Kavanaugh situation. So if you'll remember when Brett Kavanaugh was being confirmed by the Senate to be on the Supreme Court, there were all sorts of things that kept coming out. You know, there was another accusation here and another accusation there. And they, Republicans sort of feel like that's what's going to happen now. Even if impeachment, that, you know, the House impeachment part of this is over, they're still going to be putting out information they've said. So we know other things are coming out. Other people might come forward. Other court cases might reveal something. So they expect, I think, on the Republican side that it will continue, even if the Senate acquits, even if this is over, documents and witnesses may continue to come forward on this issue and others involving the president. So they feel like this is going to be a year-long thing, and it's going to obviously coincide with his reelection campaign.
Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico, thank you for talking with us this morning.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We're joined now by Michael McFaul. He's director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University and former U.S. ambassador to Russia. Ambassador McFaul, thanks for joining us on Forum.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And so we heard Anita Kumar talking about how this trial could play out. And I would love to get your take on how you think senators should treat the documents, the personal documents that were delivered by or that were sent to House intelligence investigators just a couple days ago from Lev Parnas, in terms of how they bring that into the process of determining whether or not witnesses should be called and the culpability of President Trump. Because, you know, a couple of the House Democrats, including Congressman Adam Schiff and Congresswoman Val Demings, have been pretty careful in terms of the way that they talk about this as, yes, you know, very potentially damaging, but they do have questions about Parnas's trustworthiness.
Well, a Senate impeachment trial is one of the most important, solemn things that senators have to do to honor our Constitution, right? So it seems to me, just in terms of first principles, you have to take that job very seriously. And in any other court case, in any other trial, if there was new evidence that appeared, no matter when it appeared, of course it would be considered. So I just don't even philosophically understand the argument how you could say, well, that came up too late in the process. We're not going to entertain that information. You know, in my world, in academia, you know, in science, if you're writing an article and suddenly there's new data that that undermines your original hypothesis, you don't just put your hands to your ears and say, no, I don't want to hear that. I just want to move forward. So just at the basic level, it seems like how can you ignore facts to do what is one of the most important things written in the Constitution for you to do. And number two, with respect to Mr. Parnas, whether he's right or wrong, whether he's stretching the truth or not, there's a really simple way to know. Call witnesses and put them under oath. It's just really, really simple. Was it true that Secretary Perry, for instance, floated the quid pro quo during the inauguration? Lots of people in my world are debating that. It's really easy to find out. Ask the secretary to come and testify.
You penned a piece in The Washington Post where you were talking about, you know, the public being wary of a disinformation campaign. And I was wondering where you put Senate Republicans' rush to downplay the Lev Parnas revelations and some, you know, pretty quick dismissals of Democrats' calls for further investigation.
Well, in that piece, you know, I have a lot of experience with disinformation, having studied it during the Soviet era, having tried to counter it as an Obama administration official. And then as the U.S. ambassador to Russia, I was the target of disinformation from the Russian government. And in that piece, and we have a big team here that studies this here at Stanford, by the way. For those who want to check out their work, Google Stanford Cyber Policy Center, and you'll see lots of papers. Academic papers looking at how disinformation works. But in that piece, I talk about three different kinds. One, deny the facts. Two, whataboutism, change the story. And then three, just the invention of false information. And right now, what I see is this is the first category. Just deny the facts, pretend that they don't exist, try to get through this before people uncover them. And again, I just think if this is too serious for this. And I, as I've said before, I will respect how senators decide in this impeachment trial. And that is their job. You know, I know many of them, Democrats and Republicans, by the way. This is a really serious decision that they have to make. I won't respect senators that won't allow all the facts to come forth. You know, one of their arguments, for instance, is, well, let's let the voters decide whether Trump did something wrong here or not. Okay. Well, then let us let the voters see all the facts, please, members of the Senate, right? Like, that's also part of the decision-making process for the election. And so to cover up that, to deny it, to not allow people to testify, to not allow documents to be given, that even by their own argument about let the election decide, not the Senate, they're also not allowing the voters to have full information about what happened.
What about the call by some Senate Republicans to bring Hunter Biden in or Vice President Joe Biden in as witnesses, to call them to testify? Do you consider that whataboutism?
Classic whataboutism. You know, I faced this all the time when I was a U.S. ambassador. We were talking about one thing and the Russians would say, well, what about this? You know, talking about annexation of Crimea, they would say, well, what about annexation of New Mexico? You know, and it's distraction. There's been no, I want to underscore this, there has been absolutely zero evidence that Hunter Biden broke a law. Zero. Zero. We've been talking about it for months. Zero. There is zero evidence that the vice president was involved in any wrongdoing, carrying out his responsibilities as the vice president. And you don't need to believe me. You can go back and you can read what senior Trump administration officials said, political appointees, not Democrats, not, you know, partisan people, people appointed by President Trump. They themselves, Ambassador Volker, Fiona Hill, they themselves said it time and time again. So you just can't accuse people falsely of things they didn't do and then say, well, that's the equivalent of the article's impeachment. That is changing the channel. That is distracting. And I think it's just wrong to play that game. Now, whether they, whether the vice president decides it's politically in his interest to come and say those things himself, that's a different matter. But as in terms of the facts, you know, in one set of cases, there's been an indictment based on facts. And in this other case about the Bidens, there's zero facts to support those allegations.
I'm going to invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're talking with Stanford professor and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, about the developments this week in Washington. And there's also been developments, of course, in Russia and Iran, and just about the disinformation tactics that that Ambassador McFaul has personal experience dealing with, particularly in terms of coming from the Kremlin. What are your questions for Ambassador McFaul? 866-733-6786 is the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also post your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I do want to take a moment, Ambassador McFaul, to dig a little deeper into the things that came out from Lev Parnas. I mean, there were so many very explosive things, not just the fact that he was saying that President Trump knew all of his movements, all of his activities, but also, you know, potential revelations related to surveillance of the ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. But first of all, so if you would like the public to focus on what was, you know, more solid and less speculative from Parnas's, you know, documents and the interviews he was giving, what would you say that is?
Well, first, it's a great question. For me, somebody who's followed this impeachment hearings very closely, in part because I know a lot of the people that testified last fall, one is he just added greater fidelity to the claim that the president was involved, Mr. Giuliani was involved. As Lev Parnas himself said to Rachel Maddow, why would any Ukrainian official meet with me? I'm just some obscure business person. They're only meeting with them because of that relationship to the president and Mr. Giuliani. And so all those plays, all those, you know, drug deals, as John Bolton called it, he was implementing them on behalf of the president. Second thing that was, at least for me, that became clear that was confusing in the fall was Why the effort to remove Masha Yovanovitch, Ambassador Yovanovitch? And Parnas made it clear that that was the first quid pro quo. Yuri Lutsenko, the former prosecutor general, was asked by the Trump team and Parnas himself to open an investigation of the Bidens. And by the way, Parnas said, we always said Bidens, we never said Burisma. It was always the Bidens. Lutsenko wanted something from him. He said, okay, if you want me to do that, I want you to remove Ambassador Yovanovitch. And the reason is, I know both Mr. Lutsenko and Ambassador Yovanovitch. I've known them both for decades, by the way. The reason is she, on behalf of the United States government, was critical of the lack of effort that he was demonstrating in investigating corruption. Their relationship fell apart. And Lutsenko wanted to stay on with the new president, President Zelensky. So he needed Yovanovitch to be removed so that she would stop making those allegations. And I never really figured that out, but that was the first quid pro quo. And when that fell apart, then they had to double down with military assistance. That came later.
Again, we're talking with Stanford professor and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, and we will be taking your questions and comments for the ambassador after the break. The number 866-733-6786, our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can also post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In a Washington Post op-ed this week, Stanford professor and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, talks about how the public and politicians can guard against disinformation tactics perfected by the Kremlin. We're also talking the latest impeachment developments ahead of Tuesday, when arguments are set to begin in the Senate trial to decide whether President Trump should be removed from office. Michael McFaul is director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He's also the author of From Cold War to Hot Peace, a U.S. ambassador in Putin's Russia. And he's here to take your questions, which I'll get to in just a moment when you call 866-733-6786 or post them on Facebook, Twitter, or email them to us at forum@kqed.org. Mike McFaul, I do want to ask you about your reaction to the text messages, the other revelations from Lev Parnas's sort of document reveal that show that that U.S. ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, was under electronic, potentially physical surveillance. And you mentioned before the break that you know her well. You were also an ambassador yourself. I mean, what was your reaction when you saw that or read that?
Well, just outrage. I mean, you know, ambassadors deal with very difficult circumstances. One of the chapters in the book that you just mentioned, chapter 14, is called Getting Physical. And it's about the efforts by the Russian government to harass me, to surveil me. Sometimes they would do it for me not to see, and sometimes they would do it so that I would see it as a psychological pressure on me. The big difference between me and what happened to Ambassador Yovanovitch is two things. One, it was the Russian government doing it against me. In this case, it appears it might have been an American, by the way, colluding and working, conspiring, at least exchanging messages with somebody working for the president's personal lawyer.
Yeah, you're talking about Robert Hyde, this Trump donor. Yeah. It's a new name that's emerged. Yeah.
Crazy stuff. And number two, when it happened to me, President Obama actually pushed back. He met with President Medvedev one time, and he said, knock this off. Secretary Clinton did the same. Secretary Kerry did the same. And I just wish Secretary of State Pompeo, he said a little bit about it in a radio show this morning, but it wasn't emphatic enough to me. To me, it is unacceptable that any American ambassador should be harassed along the ways that are in these texts. But it's just in Secretary Pompeo's own interest to do this. I mean, think about it. Giuliani is basically replacing the Secretary of State, carrying out diplomatic and foreign policy in a private channel. If I were Secretary Pompeo, I wouldn't put up with that. And number two, he needs to do it to, you know, regain support within the building. I have lots of friends who work in the State Department still, and I can tell you these have not been good times for them. Secretary Pompeo needs to be their leader. If he doesn't, he loses those people for the rest of his time as secretary, and that's not in his own personal interests, in my view.
Say more about that, because that really is what struck me, how relatively silent the State Department has been on the treatment of Yovanovitch, the surveillance of an American diplomat. And I know, as someone who has been in Putin's crosshairs, you know firsthand how important it is to have the State Department have your back, the Secretary of State to speak out on him, the administration to have your back as well. I mean, what is the deeply felt impact of that?
Well, first, I do, as somebody who was in the crosshairs, and sometimes, you know, literally there were death threats against me as the U.S. ambassador in Russia. It was extremely important to me and extremely important to my family that I always knew that the White House, the president himself, Secretary Clinton had my back. In fact, one time Secretary Clinton called me out of the blue. We were sitting at dinner one night, called me out of the blue on a unsecure phone line at our residence in Moscow. And it was kind of this weird conversation. It was like, and it was just, you know, hey, we got your back. You're doing a great job out there, Mike. And I saw her a month later in a more private setting. I said, why did you do that? And she said, I wanted to make sure the Russians knew, because, of course, that phone, the Russians were listening to that phone. Mm-hmm. And that's what Secretary Pompeo needs to do today. Ambassador Yovanovitch still works for the State Department. Everybody should know that. You have seen what her lawyer said about this, what just came out the last couple of days. And it's just so simple. Just put out a statement. We support the Ukrainian government's investigation into what was alleged in those texts. It would be that easy. It right. would literally take 30 seconds for his press spokesman in his name to put out that statement. And again, it's not just for the interests of the country. It's not just for the interests of Ambassador Yovanovitch. I think it's in the personal interests of Secretary of State to be able to do his job effectively.
And Joseph asks, related to this listener, he says, is there any credence to the idea that there was surveillance of Ambassador Yovanovitch as part of a campaign against her life? Of course, we heard Lev Parnas basically say that he thinks Robert Hyde was joking when he was suggesting these things and really trying to downplay that, though there could be some interest on Parnas's part to do that, of course, especially if he had any involvement in something that is a crime.
Well, I did see the interview. He laughed it off. It was just a joke. And, you know, there are lots of jokers out there, I can tell you, who claim they are doing certain things and they're not. So that's a hypothesis. But in the back of my mind is Ambassador Yovanovitch's testimony from last fall when she was told by her senior officials at the State Department, you are at risk. You need to leave now. And that has always been haunting me. What was the risk? Your security And all of those things, you know, to me, there's still lots of questions about what exactly they meant. Why did they say that? And that's, again, why it would be great if Secretary Pompeo would come and testify and tell the American people what exactly was going on with our ambassador. And you know, it is personal for me, too. This is an American patriot. This is a woman who's given her entire career, 3 decades of her life, to serving our country in sometimes very difficult places. We as the American people owe that to Ambassador Yovanovitch to know the truth about exactly what happened with her removal.
Well, let me go next to caller Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Join us.
Yes. The most shocking thing to me about the interview was his claim that the Trump activities in Ukraine, including his, were funded by a Ukrainian gas oligarch who's currently sitting in Vienna trying not to get extradited to the United States and purportedly has Russian mob ties. So it sounds like, once again, the Russian mob is funding our president, and that to me is both shocking and scary. What do you think about that?
Ambassador McPaul.
Chris, great question. You're talking about Dmitry Firtash. We indicted him long ago when I was in the government still because of charges against him here. He's been sitting in Vienna avoiding that ever since. He's a very wealthy man. He put on the payroll Mr. Parnas. Mr. Parnas then paid Mr. Giuliani. Two of these lawyers that are on Fox all the time were also paid. Extremely disturbing that was all happening. And remember, it's another one of the quid pro quos, right? Firtash is basically saying, I can help you with respect to, what you need in Ukraine, including opening the investigations. But then you got to help me. You got to get me. You got to get this indictment, this American indictment released. Now, we don't know the details. Mr. Parnas claims that the lawyers went and talked to Attorney General Barr. He categorically denies it 100%. But wouldn't it be great to get people under oath to testify about exactly what happened? There's so many things we don't know. And here, I just want to underscore this point. When I worked in the government for 5 years in the Obama administration. Every now and then there would be a story about some inner things that were happening within the Obama administration. It was only a tiny fraction of what I knew what was going on, right? And there were literally thousands of emails and documents and conversations. And it would always surprise me, what little was in the paper. This has got to be true in this case. We just know these things somewhat by accident. Wouldn't it be amazing if we got the full record, both the documentary record and the key people that were involved, the key witnesses, the key people that were in these moments when all these, again, to quote Mr. Bolton, this drug deal was going down.
Well, Chris, thanks for the question. I'm going to read two comments. Jack writes, after announcing publicly that they would not be impartial, both Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham pledge an oath of impartiality. What can be done about this? And William asks, what suggestions does Professor McFaul have for Americans to protect their republic, given that the executive branch and the Republicans in the Senate see no problem with foreign or domestic disinformation campaigns as long as they serve their party's interests?
Boy, Mina, those are tough questions. with respect to the first, all I can say when I get the chance to say it is, senators need to think about the long game here. President Trump will not be president forever. The historical record will look as to how you handled this situation. And at the end of the day, you take an oath of office to the United States of America and to the Constitution, not to the president. I took that same oath of office, both working at the White House and as ambassador. And I hope as they come closer to starting next Tuesday that they'll think about why the Constitution, why the rule of law is more important than any personal political relationship you have with an individual. And with respect to the citizens, one, stay engaged and, listen to programs like this. And number two, vote. You know, that is the most important thing you can do. That's the thing that those senators are thinking about, and be involved in the political process, no matter what your political views.
One of the strategies that I think is really clear from your piece is not to confuse denials with our understanding of the facts, because denial really is a very key tactic in all of this.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you underscored that. And that's why, you know, you can hear it in my voice. I want people to testify. I think there's so many pieces of this story that we still don't know. And you know, remember, there is such a thing as facts. I'm sitting at Stanford University here every day on my campus. 2 + 2 = 4. We don't have debates about crazy hypotheses. And by the way, you know, let's be honest, the press has a big role to play here, too. It is not good enough just to report on two alternative claims and says, well, one side says the world is round and the other side says the world is flat. And we have two alternative hypotheses that I'm reporting on them. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. We know the world is not flat. And so just to report it as if, you know, it's somebody's hypothesis, that also is, it may, whether inadvertent or deliberate, that's also fueling disinformation. And I think we all need to be more reflective about that. When we just say, well, there's been allegations that Hunter Biden broke the law, there's been no facts. There's no factual support for that claim. So just by me saying it just now, look at what I just did. I just helped to amplify something that has no factual basis. And I think we need to be more vigilant, both during the Senate trial and I think during the election process more generally.
And I think your response gets to this listener question, does the mainstream media pose a disinformation threat? And I think what you're essentially saying is, potentially, yes, but not necessarily intentionally. But
let's be clear. So mainstream media, when I hear that phrase, I immediately think of Fox. Mm. OK. Yeah. Look at the ratings. Look at who the vast majority, the mainstream of America listens to more to Fox than they do to and MSNBC. And full disclosure, I work with MSNBC. And let's be clear. So over there, I watch Fox because I want to know what they're saying. Over there, there's a lot of whataboutism, right? There's a lot of this changing the channel. But on the other places, I think there is just a, you know, wanting to be fair, give each side their voice. And that is the right way to approach reporting when you're reporting on opinions. But it is not the right way to report on facts. Everybody gets their own opinions. Nobody gets their own facts.
And again, Michael McFaul is director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University and former U.S. ambassador to Russia. Let me bring Sean from Oakland into the conversation. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning, Ambassador. And I'm going to try to phrase this into a question. Conversations with my grandfather, who is 101. So the thoughts lie that after the lies that dragged the U.S. into an endless set of circumstances in Iraq, Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld got away with murderous crimes against humanity, and not being charged by Congress has created the basis for an emboldened Trump. And what are your thoughts to that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Sean, thank you.
Tough question, Sean. A lot of tough questions today. I guess these are tough times.
Yeah, we also have really astute listeners.
You know, I think Sean raises an important point about why it's so dangerous to debase facts and evidence and data. You know, the president has been doing that a lot. And he's said there are a bunch of liars at the CIA and the FBI. They're dirty, dirty cops over there. And constantly like saying our own government, the State Department, he's taken shots at, even the military. And then when he needs the American people to believe intelligence, as he did in the run-up to his attack on Soleimani, he pivots. And it's difficult for me, and maybe difficult for other listeners, to just believe him on face value, given that he has been so, and I'm trying to be diplomatic here, so sloppy with his presentations of the facts in the past. So the imminent threat against four embassies that he said, how can we believe him? And when, you know, thankfully we have not been had a major international crisis until last week. But when we did, it really frightened me because in the previous years, the president has been so dismissive of the intelligence community and so sloppy with presentation of the facts. And that, I think, becomes especially dangerous when we're moving towards times of war, as Sean pointed out with regard to the Iraq war.
Yes, so we are hearing that there were, in fact, 11 U.S. service members who were injured during the Iranian missile attack in Iraq. And this is after the president and the Pentagon initially said that there were no casualties. And, I mean, this feels like it further undercuts the president's argument that Iran appeared to be standing down, which was already somewhat questionable when he said it, because there was a differing explanation in terms of why there weren't American casualties, which we now know there were, from, you know, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, that they basically detected the attack and were able to alert U.S. troops. And so where does this leave us, you know?
Well, I think it's very dangerous. I think it's very dangerous to manipulate information, to not reveal information, right? We're talking about denying facts. That's part of disinformation too. And especially when you get to really big decisions about war and peace, you need to be straight with the American people. And millions of Americans feel that, the Bush administration was not straight with the facts. We rushed to war without knowing all the facts. You know, my view on that, and I work here with colleagues here at Stanford who were part of that decision making, wouldn't it have been good to be more, to have more time to know all the facts, to investigate what was really going on with respect to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And moving forward, we need to demand that of the President of the United States, and we need to demand it of our representatives in Congress, because too often, this is with Democrats and Republicans, the U.S. Congress just cedes their constitutional obligations to be involved in questions about whether we go to war or not. And again, I'm thinking of your earlier caller. What can we do concretely? Hold our members, in Congress accountable for playing their constitutional role about issues of war and peace as well, and demanding the facts especially before we go to a war with a country like Iran, which would have, would be a serious, serious war that would make the war in Iraq seem very small.
Well, where do you think things will go with Iran now? I mean, we heard this morning, right, that Iran's supreme leader, gave a rare public address where he talked about slapping the face of the U.S., that the U.S. is an arrogant power. Where do you think things go now?
I don't know. And I don't believe anybody who says they do know, including the people here at Stanford who are very expert in this. I do think we should always judge the Trump administration based on the objectives that they themselves have set for their foreign policy. You go back and you read Secretary Pompeo's speech in 2018. He said our goals are to deny Iran a nuclear weapon, to reduce their support for terrorism in the region, and three, to decrease their influence in the greater Middle East, in the Middle East. And on all three of those objectives set by Pompeo, not by me, I think we're farther from achieving those objectives today than we were 3 years ago.
And it feels like Iran is closer to achieving theirs to some extent.
Yes.
With Iraq, wanting the U.S. out and so on. But anyway, to your earlier point about how we try to protect against disinformation, Heather is asking us, this listener, about how we do it in our own lives. She writes, it is both admirable and necessary to guard against disinformation, but can you speak a bit about how to address this in our personal lives? When people we know insist on repeating disinformation, what can we do or what should we do?
Well, in my own interactions, I really try to make a big distinction between let's agree on the facts and the evidence and the data, and then let's have a conversation about our different opinions about that. You know, newspapers rightly have an opinion piece that is a section of the paper that is separated from the reporting. So I think that's useful. And, you know, in my own conversations with people that with whom I disagree, I think it's good to kind of set the baseline about the facts and then move to opinion. Number two, I think we need to guard against inadvertently propagating disinformation. I myself am guilty of this. I have a large social media following. I think 500,000 people these days. Follow me at McFall if you want to join the conversation after our conversation is over. And, you know, my instinct that comes from my training in the government, because I was one of the first ambassadors to be on Twitter when I first joined Twitter in 2012, by the way, at the direction of Secretary Clinton. It was not my idea. But our motivation there was always to present facts about American foreign policy in our country. And we were constantly seeking engagement with those that were putting out different, disinformation or things we disagreed with. Sometimes I inadvertently, by refuting disinformation, am also amplifying it. Because I have a large following, and some of the trolls that harass me are deliberately trying to throw in disinformation, hoping that I will say you're wrong. But sometimes in saying you're wrong, they said it to 50 people that follow them, and then I say it to 400,000 that follow me. I'm inadvertently amplifying disinformation. And then the third thing is just always, this is with the press especially, none of this, equal treatment to things that are not equal in fact. I think that is one of the most important things that everybody can do. False equivalency is a very dangerous part of, again, whether inadvertent or not, but of amplifying disinformation.
Well, let me go next to Lorenzo in San Anselmo. Hi, Lorenzo.
Thank you. I've always had a question of why the Inspector General, why the Inspector General was not called as a witness. When the Republican Party has requested the whistleblower, wouldn't the Inspector General have been able to fill that role and satisfy their request, and at the same time present his evidence of why and his testimony of why it was necessary and why he felt it was justified to follow up on the whistleblower's complaint and his findings?
You're talking about the original whistleblower complaint, the Inspector General, the CIA officer, all of that?
Correct.
I completely agree. I think he would have been a terrific witness, especially because there's been a lot of confusion about the rights and responsibilities to protect whistleblowers, right? And I think having the Inspector General come and testify would have been useful to filling out the full picture here. And I think it is, since you brought it up, I think it is important to understand that the whistleblower and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, they never in their wildest dreams thought that this was going to become a public event. At least that's the way I've interpreted what Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has said publicly. And I think a lot of people are confused about that they don't understand that, in fact, we do have these systems in place precisely to raise this, concerns. But protecting people so that they do not feel, retribution. And I most certainly saw that when I was in the U.S. government. And I don't think all of America fully understands why those protections are important.
Well, Aaron tweets, I'm curious to know what Professor McFall thinks regarding why the Ukrainians might have been holding back announcing an investigation of the Bidens, as Parnas has alleged.
Because they saw it was crazy. They agreed with John Bolton that this was a drug deal. They felt like they were being pressured to do something that they know had no validity. Like, why would you open an investigation when you may have looked into it and saw that there were no facts? That makes you look like you are just being pulled into a political fight here in the United States. And it's especially tragic, in my view, as somebody who's worked on and traveled to Ukraine and written about Ukraine for decades now, because we have been telling the Ukrainians, we have been lecturing the Ukrainians for decades now that you can't use the rule of law for private gain. You can't open criminal investigations against your opponents as a way to sideline them. That's what we've been telling them you've got to clean up. And here is exactly in reverse what we then were asking them to do on our side. It is the definition of corruption, using your public office for private gain. That is the definition of corruption. And we were asking them to be involved in our corrupt actions. And I give President Zelensky, credit, by the way, for pushing back and slowing down and rolling this out so that he never eventually had to do it. That took some doing. I give him credit for that.
Well, we just have a minute left, but I do want to ask you, you've talked about Russian-style disinformation tactics employed by Americans or Russians. So is there something specific that you feel like we should be on the lookout for from Russia, or something you're already seeing from them? And we just have 30 seconds.
It's all a blur out there. Remember, the Russians are on Twitter, on Facebook, and everywhere, and they're amplifying the same messages that some of these Americans are doing in disinformation. And I just say, greater vigilance. Let's protect ourselves from disinformation from Russia or the United States.
Michael McFaul, professor at Stanford University and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, really appreciate having you on this morning.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Mina Kim. Thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. Another Hour Forum is next. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.